Welcome to Access to Perspectives Conversations, the podcast for bridging academic landscapes. At Access to Perspectives, we provide novel insights into the communication and management of research. Our goal is to equip researchers around the world with the skills and enthusiasm they need to pursue a successful career. You will get insights around the topics of scholarly reading, writing and publishing, career development, project management, and research integrity, all embedded into open science practices. Learn more about our work at accesstoperspectives.org.
So, welcome to another episode of Access to Perspectives Conversation. Today we have Jia Ng in the house. I'm very glad that you're here, by the way. Welcome, very warm welcome.
Thank you.
And for you out there, so Jia is a nephrologist and assistant professor at the Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra, Northwell, New York, and also the publisher, also the founder of Published MD, which is a consultancy firm and coaching firm to support clinical researchers, primarily, not exclusively, I suppose, in getting the work published. And you do that quite brilliantly. That's how I discovered your work on my case, LinkedIn, where you share a lot of highly useful tips and tricks on, it's not really tricks, but best practices rather, on how to organize your research so that it's now then also easy to get published, or relatively easy, straightforward, and to you sensitize researchers on the best practices. So nothing more, nothing less, and in a really concise and engaging and colorful and embracing way. So let's hear it from you. And as a starting point, maybe if you could add to what I just said, whatever you want. And also, tell a bit more about your background, what brought you here, where you are as a researcher and also entrepreneur, serving the medical research community. And that's where I hold it for a minute. So please go ahead. And thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much, Joe. It's my pleasure to be here. And always love connecting with people on LinkedIn because people are always very civil and there's good content there. A little bit about myself. I am a nephrologist and actually went into research as a side thing. I started doing a little bit of smaller projects and realized that I wasn't very good with the science part. You know, you go into medical school, you learn to be a doctor, but not the science part. So when I did my fellowship, I took a master's and learned about research. And after my master's, I came out with zero publications, which was really hard. It's almost like, you know, you finish training and you have no product, no results coming out. And so I was fortunate.
Sorry to interrupt, but can I just hold you there? Like on a undergrad level, they expect you to already publish, because for me in bio, maybe it's also a European thing, and biological sciences, we were expected to publish sometime throughout the PhD, not before necessarily.
You know, because I'm a physician, by the time I did my master's, I was like in the mid 20s already. And my colleagues, they are quote unquote physician researchers. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of them are publishing papers, not fully researched, but narrative review papers, case reports, case series, you know, but I went into the full research route. I had nothing. Oh, okay. And so just comparing with my peers, I was like, oh, I had nothing coming out.
Also not a fair comparison to yourself to start.
Right. It wasn't, but there were also other people who were in the same journey and path was really getting stuff out. And that was kind of, why am I not being able to publish paper? It was the whole transition from the research, how do we tell the story, and transforming into the paper. That was the revelation. Uh-huh. And during faculty, I took that 3 years to take it really seriously. Okay, this is, I need to work on the writing part. And I focus a lot on that. Mm-hmm. And then over 3 years, took a lot of courses, had coaches, and then kind of got into a breakthrough, published a lot at that time. And I realized there are people like me mm-hmm. who love the science, but don't know how to tell the story or don't know how to move to the writing part. So I'm like, okay, what can I do to help people while continuing this journey myself, continuing to grow as a researcher, to be a principal investigator, but also guide those who are coming up, getting into this journey, how to do that at the same time. So that's kind of my journey from being a physician to a physician / researcher.
Okay, well, that makes a lot of sense. And also my own experience is I wasn't aware as a PhD student or not to speak about anywhere before then, but through graduate school and your research education, so to say, we as academics require so many skills that other people in the industry world or in other sectors get certificates for. And we have to sit it through until we have the PhD, and then we still would have to explain to anybody outside academia, this is what I actually know. And it's so unspecific, mm-hmm. specific on individual scale that you or we should bear. There's a whole other sector of us entrepreneurs serving scholars, which we also have on this podcast. And we had a few conversations on how to customize your CV and your whole appearance line and public profiles that job hunters or employers can actually acknowledge what you've gained as an academic.
Yeah.
And with that comes also either being a natural writer and finding it easy, as you say, or not to package your findings into text. And most people struggle, and that's a normal thing, but we all still have to acquire that skill one way or the other. And most people take the long route by hopefully having some guidance from peers or having consultants like yourself to get them.
Right.
Okay, so now we're here. You also in our conversations before this recording, you shared with me that you're also a mother. Mm-hmm. And I'm not asking how did that happen, but what I would love to for you to share with us, how did motherhood and also how the whole transition of I'm pregnant and how can I fit into my research to becoming a mother and changing, putting my life head over heels, basically.
So I actually I became a mother when I was an intern during residency program. So for the audience who don't know what that means is after medical school in the US, in most countries, that after medical school, you're technically a doctor, but not a fully trained doctor. You still need to go through something called residency program where you do practical. You become a doctor under supervision, like an internship resident, and then you specialize. At first year of my training, that's when I had my first child by choice because I was deciding based on biological aging. So I've always had some thought that I want to have my children before I turn 30. And so I had that intention. So mm-hmm. I had my first one when I was an intern, my second child when I was a third year resident. And it was hard. It was very hard because most people say internship is the most difficult time of your medical training period because you go from the books into the practical part. You know, we're talking long hours, 80-hour weeks, there's night shift, day shift, and then I have to nurse, I have to like pump. I took a very short maternity leave, only 4 weeks for my first, 6 weeks for my first child, 4 weeks for my second child. Not, and also intentional, not because the department wouldn't give me more, it's because I was on a visa. And because I'm on a visa, there's a timeline. You know, I have to finish my training before then. If not, they're like, oh, sorry, you have to leave. And I don't want to be in a position where I have to leave when I haven't finished training like that. And then I would have wasted like 4 years, but nothing. So it was some sacrifices that I had to make. But fortunately, I had a lot of support. So the program was very supportive. I was the first resident who had a child who had I was the second, but the older one was a chief resident. But he was very supportive, like, okay, you actually need 2 months of light rotation, he mm-hmm. told me. You can't jump straight into the difficult rotation when you first start. Come back. You need time away. You need, you know, so he was giving a lot of guidance because of his wife's experience. And the attendings or the consultants really gave me opportunity to like step away to do my nursing and pumping. And colleagues would like say, hey, let me get you lunch. Let me hold your pager. So these were like the small things they did that made such an impact in my life that, you know, even thinking back, I'm like, they are going to be such great doctors. They're going to be such great parents. You know, all these small things people did for you 10 years ago.
They're so considerate. They along and they're empathetic and they actually act on it also.
Yeah, right. And because of that, it kind of created this culture that the next intern who wanted to get pregnant, they felt like, oh, Gia did it. I could do it too. Mm-hmm. And this is what I needed to do. So it created a nice culture.
Sweet. Do you feel like there is room and space and opportunity to institutionalize such supportive measures?
Yes, absolutely. So the more resources they are, the better. And the more people with experience, the better. So somebody who is really thinking from the new parent, it doesn't even have to be only mother, but as a new parent, remember how it is. We forget it's so difficult. We forget, you know, that the body is beaten up after and the brain is slower. And so that I was, you know, the star intern may not be a star intern after they come back because they're foggy, they're not as efficient anymore. Just even knowing that sort of things.
Like being in long COVID. I'm sorry. Yeah.
like the fog that comes back. So just having that sort of understanding and also redundancy. That's one thing I would say is that you can't have a program that is so like you have to depend on that 8 people. If one comes off sick, pregnancy, the whole thing collapses. We can't, you know, it always have to be a little bit more people to cover more, to cover that amount of work than what's required. That way, when somebody's sick, got an accident, okay, then we reshuffle. So I think that's some cultural thing too, where that we need some redundancy. Not each person needs to like squeeze every juice out of their career or out of their work hours or effort, but redundancy in the program.
Yeah. Like building systems. I've learned this like first the hard way and then say to realize, oh, it's not going to work the way I do it. But then I took a business growth program for 2 years where we were very supportive as a community and also had beautiful guidance by the facilitators in building systems to have templates and then to actually make use of these and to invest in people so that you can have less pressure on each other's shoulders. That makes sense. Like on your shoulders, but as a team as well.
I felt really bad taking maternity leave off or taking time off because when I'm off, everybody had to take over my stuff. And it's like my decision became other people's problem, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like I felt icky too. So if the system allowed that sort of a flexibility, then I feel, okay, well, if my child is sick, I can take time off. I don't feel guilty, you know, because everybody has some space.
Has the space and also the information so they know what they can do to compensate. Yeah.
Right.
Okay, but that's also coming back to what you do, like the value that you provide as an entrepreneur to the scientific community. So could you share with us some tips of what you anyways share on social media with regards to how do you, also from your personal experience, how do you encourage a clinical aspiring or actual already researcher to organize themselves so that, like with the documentation and archiving, with the whole team in mind, Like, have you found a folder structure and also a folder sharing system that worked for you guys? I don't know if you want to mention brand names, like the usual. Well, here we come also, especially with clinical research. I don't think you would ever use Google Drive, even though it's an easy, or the regulations are not as harsh in the US as they are in Europe. But just because there's personal data involved with client patient data. But
right.
But what are three things that you can share with the listeners? Okay, here's how you organize yourself as a researcher, which also make your personal life easier, so you don't have the pressure that you just described, and you can support your team as they chip in to compensate your absence.
So I'm going to start with my personal first before attacking the team one. So as a personal, I really kind of organize my time, because I still have the clinical side and the research side. So I have to kind of do both. And as a clinician, the biggest transition is we train as a doctor and we can't let our patients go. Means if somebody says, can you see this patient urgently? And we always want to see them. We always want to take that phone call, and then we'll never do science. Mm-hmm. So first one, I would say, is a mindset shift, where when I have blocked my time for research time and writing time, I am helping patients. Mm-hmm. I'm helping the future patient. I'm helping 1,000 patients at a time instead of one patient at a time. So first one was the mindset shift. If not, you can say how you want to reorganize your time, but you can't execute it, because like, I know I blocked that 2 hour, or that Tuesday is my writing day, but I can't do it because I keep adding patients to my schedule. Mm-hmm. So first is just kind of split. When I schedule it, it's research time, I am impacting. Then second is I'm 75% research and 25% clinical. So I deliberately divide all my work. Monday is my full clinic day. I don't take breaks, like just clinic, patient. And then on Tuesday morning is where I do all phone calls. I call all patients, like nonstop. That way I don't waste any time. There's no phone tags. I call patient, then they call me back and I miss that. You know, these are like time wasters. Okay. So I coach my patients. I usually call on Tuesday mornings with results. Is that good for you? Mm-hmm. Okay. Also, I try to make them do blood tests before. That way, when I see them in the clinic, we are just going through the results. I'll show them the picture. I'll show them the graph. So it's a meaningful conversation and a visit, right? Mm-hmm. So now it's only like one day. And then the rest of the week is all my research days, okay? So Tuesday, I like to have 2 days just for meetings and like administrative tasks. Mm-hmm. So all my meetings with my research assistant, the project manager, is always on Tuesdays. Meetings, conversations are typically on Fridays. And then Wednesdays and Thursdays are usually my deep work day, where for me, I like my 3 hour block to kind of think, to write, or to like think about, okay, which one has a roadblock or a bottleneck? If this one has a bottleneck, I need to like do these three things. That way I can push the ball forward to another person so that people are not waiting for me. So I have like some deliberate organization in terms of time-wise. And then in teams, how I like personally is two things. One, thinking about systems. So I have personal systems and research system, where I have things like my standard operating procedure, all the resources. Every time I learn something new, like something that's new for me, for example, I need to apply for a patient compensation cards. You know, every time you recruit patient, you need to give them money. Mm-hmm. So we need special cards for that. I'm like, oh, how do I do that? Who do I need to find out? How do I apply? What are the forms? Mm-hmm. Every time I know it's something I have to do three times, I immediately create a standard operating procedure. Sometimes I do screen record, recording, and I put it in my Notion. Mm-hmm. That way, the next person who needs to do that, I'm like, okay, every time you do this, this is how you do it. This is the button you need to click. This is the contact you need to email. These are the forms. Mm-hmm. So I don't have to teach them again. And because these are the things that don't happen all the time, I may forget in 6 months. So I like go back to my repository of my systems repository or SOPs to do that. So I have like categories for that. Even personal life, I have an SOP or a Notion a dashboard with my family, my husband. So even random things like all the doctor's appointments, the phone numbers, the policies, health policy, life policy, insurance, all these things are there. That mm-hmm. way we like, okay, is it due yet? We just look. So this is kind of general how I kind of think about my life in systems so that people can replicate. And the personal life is actually more important than you think, because especially when you have children, what if I die and now my husband doesn't know all the doctors, because I've always been the one who bring the kids to the doctor's
appointment. You don't have to die right away. You can also get
I know.
And then recover. Right.
It's like just all these things that, right.
Right. Sorry. Yeah, I don't want to scare myself off, let alone nurse. Please don't die just yet.
Yeah, right. I'm not gonna die just yet, but I do like to be prepared for if I'm sick, he knows what to do.
Yeah. Without you having to explain much, like, gosh, can I just focus on getting better again? Don't ask me all these questions.
yes. Right.
Okay, nice. I use Notion as well. I wasn't gonna drop brand names necessarily, but I've already mentioned Google, so why not also Notion? Because it's so brilliant. The only thing is to the listeners, so both companies are US-based. The information you share through these systems will be hosted and probably also investigated in the United States, or maybe not investigated by default, but could be done so legally. And you might, especially when you're from Europe, we have harsh regulations when it comes to data privacy and also patient data. So do not put any research data on any such system. But for that, there's systems and photo structures that you can set up on a secure server. I mean, these are also secure servers. I think Google and Notion are probably the most secure servers or amongst the most secure we can find, but it's just about the access to that. Having said that, also as soon as any system is connected to the internet, it will be hacked sooner or later, as we've seen Western governments being hacked. So there's no 100% security, but researchers, we want to be accountable and do the best we can.
I want to be clarified. The Notion, it's only systems that are non-patient.
Sorry, I didn't want to excuse you as if, and I heard you also, this is for personal, and I also use Notion for personal stuff and
personal systems, research systems, but these are research systems that are not like where I store actual patient data. That we have, like, it has to be a HIPAA safe. That is completely different system. We have OneNote. Everything has to be like within the universities approved. The HIPAA is like the US thing about patient record sharing. So we cannot have any identifiers. So just to be clear with the audience.
Yeah, glad that you also add to that clarification. As I said before, I didn't want to get the impression as if I thought you did that. But then the good thing is, once you have a system, you can transfer it on different platforms. And so the same photo structure, you can also set up on a self-hosted server situation for whichever type of data.
Right. That's true.
So, okay. So being organized, that helps. I have to admit, I am... Like for the longest time of my life, what's the past tense of priding oneself? I was proud to say that I'm not super structured, because I thought it was a cool thing. So that I live in the chaos. Or in German, we also have this phrase or saying where it's like, oh, life is all about structure. Half of life is all about structure. I live in the other half, kind of thing. So. Like, that's supposed to be funny, but I can testify that the real life scenarios are only funny so long until you face your chaos. It's like, what the heck have I done and not done? So building structures and systems actually makes the life easier, and especially as a entrepreneur, and even more just as much as a researcher. And most researchers, at least on the biosciences, I think clinical researchers are more organized by default, as a type of people because they have, I don't know, that's just my personal non-scientific based observation. But biologists tend to be like super chaotic and all obsessed with, oh, nature and complexity, it's so nice. And yes, it's chaotic, but that's, it's supposed to be that way because good things come out of it. And they do also in entrepreneurship. So there is some logic to it, but some structure is still there. And nurture that is the important thing for us. So structure, we've covered that. And now when it comes to publishing, so what's like one thing you'd like to share? What's for you personally, from your own experience also as a clinician, as a researcher, as a practitioner, why is it for you important to inform other scholars and how to publish? Like what's your motivation in teaching how to publish?
Right. Other
than you just said earlier, like is adding to that a little bit.
So at the beginning, it was really just, you know, I think this is going to be helpful for somebody because it was very painful. It was difficult. And, you know, let me see what I can share. If I can help one people move up a step, that would be good. And then it slowly evolved into, I went into science to help patients, right? To increase the impact. When I see clinic patients, I help one at a time. When I publish a paper, maybe I can help 100 or 1,000 at a time, depending on the impact and what sort of research I'm doing. But if I can help 1,000 physicians or clinicians publish their papers, that means my impact is like 100 times 100 or 1,000 times 1,000. That means I'm helping a million patients or 10 million patients at a time. And so that became like even a small thing, not a small thing, even a thing that was born out of pain could be so impactful. And I love small things like that. Like,
yeah.
So that's how it came to be. And I realized that when I did that, you know, when you start to try to teach people, the better you get and the more you learn. And so I was getting a lot of pleasure I was getting a lot of insights out of it. And I felt like I grew through learning about writing, communication, and all the transferable skills as I pursue this journey. Like even thinking about work-life balance. When I had no side business, I was using my time a little bit more loosely. Then until I took on another thing, now like, okay, it has to be more structured. I think about systems. So compared to some of my peers, I started thinking about systems like 3 years ahead. Mm-hmm. When I need systems now because I have no time to do anything else, if not, right? So it kind of pushed my growth a lot further. Thinking about completing projects means you grow to be somebody who can complete things, finish things. You can communicate better, like not just writing, but speaking. Because how you write is how you think, and how you think is how you can speak better too. So there were a lot of small things that are intangible, and I grew, I learned a lot out of it.
Yeah, I have similar experiences in my teaching and mentoring and coaching. All right, so I would, thanks for sharing that, by the way. Not by the way, but actually, thanks. And now you mentioned earlier briefly that you, with a migrant status, and please correct me, I think you came to the United States as a small child, or were you even born here? But you had
No, I came here to do residency training for medicine. So 2012, I came in with a visa.
Right. Either way, so there's many reasons why people have migrant status. And then are in grad school or whatever research education program. And you said it put on pressure. And I want to go back there and, like, if you could share your personal journey in how you found a way to mitigate that pressure, or to, like, also people, systems, references, and resources that helped you.
Mm.
because there's a lot of people that do graduate school in a different country, which comes with similar, if not the same, challenges that you've been experiencing.
Right.
And yeah, and I think it's one thing to just share the story to let others know, look, I've been through this, and yes, it's been hard, but here we are, and it's gonna, we can pull through this, and here's how I managed.
Mm. So, you know, every visa situation, every country is different. So I'm going to just give my story based on what I went through. I came with something called H1 visa, where it's like a, in medicine, there is a large number of foreign graduates or non-US doctors who they need to, they need doctors here. So that's why they take in foreign graduates. That's number one. And then I come from Malaysia. That H1 can be transferred into a green card, a permanent resident, after certain years, and if another employer is willing to sponsor it. And so I was going through that route, but the deadline for that first visa is 7 years. And so I had this time pressure of, okay, I need to finish my thing within 7 years. And then in the meantime, find an employer who can like sponsor my green card. So there's always this background thing that I'm always worried about. And then my spouse, when he first came in, he could not work because at that time, the visa is the spouse of H1 cannot work unless they get a working visa by themselves. And so for the first 2 years, he wasn't working. I was having like a minimum wage salary supporting two people and a baby. And then he finally got a job in software consulting, and where he got his own visa. Mm-hmm. And then his company actually sponsored the green card a lot faster.
Oh, nice.
And so then I became a permanent resident. And the thing about visa and all is that sometimes when you choose a program, how we get these visas is based on how we match which program. Some program will sponsor certain type of visa. Some are like student visas. Some are exchange visas. The one I specifically won was this H1, so that it could eventually become a green card. And so there were programs that were probably at like a more fancy place, higher name, but did not just get this visa. But I was quite strategic that, you know, when it comes to the US, the visa status and your citizenship status or green card status is actually more important than where you would train. And so I needed that type of visa. After that, once you switch type, doors open, because people who were in like fancy Ivy League residency program but still on a different type of visa could not move forward until they have to go somewhere else, change the different type of visa. So I had like strategic plans when it came to choosing which type, and knowing that I just need to suffer a few years, and then after that, after a certain point, doors will open for me. So think about, I don't have specific advice for each individual person, but really think about long-term rather than the short-term. You know, we like to say, oh, I want to be in Harvard, I want to be in that, but and do they give that type of visa? You know, are they going to switch? Are you going to be long-term worse off? Like, really think truly about the long-term plan, not just the short-term.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And also to trust that resources are available. You can do some desk research on your own. You can inquire support and assistance. You don't have to figure it all on your own.
Right.
Just ask around. People have already done that, and which approach they took.
Also, we actually had lawyers. When it comes to visa, you definitely need lawyers' help. You can't like file all these things yourself. So get lawyers who are specialized in certain type of visas. Like, immigrant visa. You can't just get any lawyer because they are specialized in different things. So make sure you choose one who is like, okay, immigrant visa. Another one is contract visa, you know, contract lawyer, or different type of lawyers for different things.
Yeah. All right. When you say lawyer, isn't that expensive, just generally speaking? But then it might save a lot of time, and maybe they're also affordable.
Right. You want a good one so that they do it properly.
Unfortunately, such like many cases vital, not life-threatening or life-saving, but otherwise bureaucracy vital information is not necessarily readily available on the internet. but there might be some guidance that you can find out yourself. Otherwise, find an expert to guide you.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
All right. Now, I think we covered all the talking points we've agreed upon. So building resilience with motherhood. Okay, so now concluding for maybe the last 2-3 minutes, how would you summarize your journey as in, or how is your life today, bringing together your professional status as a medical researcher / practitioner, clinician, as an entrepreneur, as a mother? How does that, it seems like you've sorted it out, you're well organized, you have your systems in place. Of course, there's some tweaking and adapting and adjusting here and there along the way, like maintenance. But are you in a happy place today? Or what's missing to be there? So either it's fair.
Oh, such a great question. If you asked me this question 6 months ago, I would say, yeah, you know, I'm on track on everything. And then over the past 6 months, I started to reflect more. I think, you know, we go through different growth journey. I've always been, let me do everything structured. I love organization. I like systems. I like everything very as structured as possible. I like to use up every single free time for productivity. Mm-hmm. You know, everything that's not quote unquote inefficient, I don't like doing. You know, I will have ear pods everywhere so that I'm always listening to either a course or a podcast. It has to be educational, you know, it can't be entertaining. No music. I don't believe in music. It has to be, you know, I'm always about efficiency.
Wow. Okay. So,
yeah, which is actually not good. And
but it can be. That's your way to relax. I think it's fair. Don't beat yourself up. You know, but if you come to talk about it just after.
But you know, then I realize is that I constantly have input in my mind.
Okay.
No, I don't have space for the brain to process. Mm-hmm. Right. So when you don't take the space to process, you're just having things just going through, passing through the mind, mm-hmm. and you're not really using the brain to make connections and think and apply all these things that you have listened from the podcast. Like, huh? I wonder if that is useful. Is it not? Am I feeling good about this? How can I apply this to my science? Oh, can I apply this to my a personal life? Can I apply this to my research? Mm-hmm. Right. I did not have that space to think. It's not like I did not. I just did not give the opportunity to do that.
And what people say when you speak of digesting the information, to actually processing and weighing.
But you actually.
Or implementing even.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That little space in between, which is really important. And my research assistant asked me recently, is there any inefficient thing you do that you're inefficient? And it really made me ask, wow, I never do anything like that. So it became more deliberate that there are inefficient things that I should start doing, which is when I walk my kids to the bus stop, not have anything in my ears and just enjoy the air. Enjoy the birds, so that if they decide they suddenly want to say something, I'm ready to catch the funny things they say. You know, if not, I used to be like, okay, if you want to tell me something, you pause, I'll take off, you can tell me. But it's no longer organic, and you lose that like spontaneity. And so I would say this quarter, I'm going to give myself more space to think, where not just to think, but to process. And one more thing I was also going to, this concept I learned is a Japanese word called ma, okay, which is the in-between space between everything, in-between space of time, in-between space conversation. And these are not vacuum or empty space, but an actual presence, okay? All these dark spaces are actual presence. And we forget how important it is, because if you think about speeches that are really important, they tend to pause to give the presence and energy, right?
The so pause. Allow the listeners to actually hear.
Digest,
what
yes. Yeah. They get the tension. They get ready for it. But you were like, if you're all nonstop, you sound so nervous. You can't process. Like you don't have enough gravitas. So it's this in-between spaces and actual presence that I want to start cultivating. And not just in the speech way sense, but in every part of my life, let me create the space in between.
I think it's also a burden that our generation has, as in the digital era, because I try to unlearn this, or to kind of build this back, the habit of I'm calling my mom to check on her, how are you doing? And, oh yeah, I'm checking in just to have a chat. And then at the same time answering emails. And she notices and is like, you're not listening, or you're hearing me, but you're not actually listening. And that's so disrespectful. She actually gets upset and angry. And first I was like, oh, come on, give me a break. I have work to do. But it's so unfair. It's also so harmful to our relationship. And then also when you, like what you said earlier, like for kids, when they feel they have to interrupt their parents to get their attention from whatever they think important they're doing. And then, oh, I just want to share, look how beautiful the sunshine is today. Or, oh, have you seen that funny spot down there at the road?
Yeah.
At the road.
Right.
They want to share that. And they have a right.
Yeah, they're going to like keep it. Like, I guess it's not that important. You know, they will keep that thought to themselves. And right, if you don't give them the space to interrupt you spontaneously.
And engage. It's so important to engage for any human being at any time and age, but especially for kids. So well done for taking this journey. I think that, like with the digital era, there's so much pressure. Also the information age we're in. Like, I don't think humans had to ever process so much information through so many different channels and being on alert. Like, it's been a few years now that I shut off any notifications on my phone, and I see colleagues and friends having them on all the time with sounds and what. I was like, how can you live that way? Like, it's still stressful to me, for me, even with those things switched off. But like we're not doing each other any favors, and the efficiency suffers so bad.
Right. And not everything has to be efficient, you know. I think when you're
like the efficiency, if we think we're being overly efficient by kind of multitasking, whatnot, which is basically not possible for our brains,
right?
But to come to that realization takes so much time and try and error and more errors. Like, I think I spent 70 years on that. Oh, yeah, I'm so good at multitasking. No, I'm not. Because we're actually switching between tasks, and the brain takes time to dig into one task. Mm-hmm. It takes at least 2, 3, 5 minutes to get into, like, what I think also runners call the runner's high. You have to run for 20 minutes until you get there. Mm-hmm. And for any task to be processed, be it writing an email, it takes half a minute to get into the space of the content and what am I doing here before you're actually doing the work. And if we keep interrupting ourselves and being distracted, we take an hour for something that could be done in 3 minutes. Like, I've observed myself long enough and have too many of such situations. And now I'm trying to practice the, like, things like, that's what I share in the project management and time management courses, things like the Pomodoro technique, and to give yourself like dedicated time. Also what you said earlier, chunks of time for one thing to do, taking care of patients, being approachable to patients half a day, that day in the week. And then they feel they're being taken care of. They feel somebody's listening, actually listening, not just hearing stuff. And it's doing us a good as well.
Right.
Sorry, I got into a monologue here. My whole efficiency. No, where I interrupted you, apologies. It's like, so there's that part, we think we're being efficient and we're actually achieving the opposite. But in the long term, maybe short term it seems as if, but long term it's really not. But it's a good thing we came to notice that.
I can't agree more. Like, sometimes speed is not efficient. We may think it's efficient, but speed itself may not be efficient if you look at the big picture in long term.
Right. Yeah, I have like the whole thing with strategic reading, like academic reading, and then there's things like speed reading. It's really not like you can't speed read a research article. You just cannot. You need to kind of strategically approach with specific questions. What am I going to learn? What do I want to learn from this article? And that has nothing to do with speed. But you become more time sensitive and more time rewarding by being strategic about it. And that will save time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
it's not that I have my, like that I know all of these things, how to do them in practice, when in theory it works perfectly.
No, you're right. Like, there are so many AI tools now teaching you how do you read fast? How do you, it's not really reading, the summarizing. I've tested all of it. I've tried 6 months to like, see, you know, an elixir for me. Then I realized, even though they've done all the work, I don't remember any of them, unfortunately. So at the long run, yeah, it gave the appearance that I read a lot of papers, but nothing was in the mind. And the goal of reading the paper is to have ideas and insights bubble up. And to do that, you actually have to engage and really dig into the paper and read. And it's, the goal is to learn and not to have eyes passing through words, right? Speed reading is eyes passing through words, and that's not the point. The point is to gain something out of it.
Exactly. Cool. That's a nice wrap up. Thank you so much for this session. And I'm sure we hear more of you. We like, to the listeners, you will find all of Gia's profiles and contact details, as in LinkedIn profile and Instagram and others, where you can follow her work. And we have more things to talk about, as we've touched upon. Thank you so much for sharing so much with us today. And welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for joining us to listen to this episode. Do let us know what you think. You can email us or connect with us on our social media channels, which you can find on our website at accesstoperspectives.org. Email us at info@accesstoperspectives.org or book a call to explore how we can support you with your research planning, management, and publishing. Welcome you again soon for our next episode. Until then, have a great time.